This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Chilean writer Isabel Allende has said she divides her life before and after September 11, 1973. That was the day a military junta overthrew the Marxist government headed by her uncle, Salvador Allende, who was killed during the coup. She stayed in Chile after the coup, working with the underground, then fled to Venezuela. In Chile, she had been a journalist. It wasn't until she was 39 years old that she started writing fiction. Her novels, The House of the Spirits of Love and Shadows and Evil Luna, are set in Latin America. But her new novel, The Infinite Plan, is her first set in the United States. She's lived in California since 1988, when she married an American. Her new novel is about the son of an itinerant preacher who has created a metaphysical religion he calls The Infinite Plan. Allende's interest in unusual expressions of spirituality is connected to her grandmother, who was a spiritualist.
My grandmother was a wonderful character, and she's the character of my first novel, The House of the Spirits. Actually, they're making a movie now, and Meryl Streep is my grandmother in the movie. So I feel honored that I have such a grandmother. In real life, she was always experimenting with telepathy and trying to move objects without touching them. Actually, telepathy worked much better than the Chilean telephone company.
Did she hold seances?
Yes, every Thursday.
And you went to them?
I was very, very young, but I do remember part of it. My grandfather, who was a pragmatic Basque, opposed all this. But then one day my grandmother decided that it was not the souls of the dead that moved the three-legged table, but maybe extraterrestrials. Now that was scientific. So my grandfather accepted the seances, and then I could see them.
Do you remember what it was like to be at one of her seances?
Yeah, it was always at daylight. It was nothing. There was nothing spooky about it. Very open and funny. And she had three friends who were just as crazy as she was. And they communicated with spirits, they thought.
Do you think of yourself as being a spiritual person?
It's too much, too big a word, spiritual. But I'm aware that I'm not only mind and body, that there is something else. And in my recent experience, I had a daughter who was very, very sick, and she recently died. I think that I have come much deeper into that sense of the soul, that there is a lot there.
You spent a lot of time with her when she was dying.
Yeah, she was with her. I was with her for a year. She was in coma for a year, and I had her at home. And then she died in my arms, and that changed my life and my perspective of life.
Right. This happened in the United States?
Yes. It happened in December.
Oh, it was very recent. I didn't realize it was that recent.
Yes, it's very recent.
Living in the United States and being around English-speaking people a lot of the time, is that a strain for you?
I'm another person in English. All the basic things in my life are always in Spanish, like food and making love. I would feel ridiculous panting in English or writing fiction in English.
Can you be funny in English?
No. I can't be funny. That's the worst. But I can be really funny in Spanish, you know. I'm very oral in Spanish, and I can really be funny.
They say that's what I imagine is such a strain when you're in when you're in a culture in which that isn't your native tongue. I mean, can you be funny with your husband, who's American?
He speaks Spanish.
Oh.
And but I think he doesn't get it quite well. Sometimes I try to make a joke, and he doesn't get it. But it doesn't matter. He gets other stuff, so it's okay. And he can make love in Spanish. I suppose it's very stressful for him, but he can. He tries, at least.
Have you been back to Chile since the end of the Pinochet regime?
Yes, I go back every year. Except last year when my daughter was sick, I've been back every year.
What was the first time you were back?
Oh, I can't tell you. When I left my country, it was a winter day, and I was running away without my family, and I was very scared. And then, many years later, I returned in a radiant summer day with Willie, my new husband. And there was a crowd waiting for me in the airport. It's like a metaphor of my life. My life goes up and down. I'm always pushed to the limits.
And when you returned, was that after the Pinochet regime?
Yes. It was. Well, it was for the plebiscite.
So you returned during the election?
Yes.
Yeah, I guess we were really hoping for the best.
I think that everybody knew that we would get rid of the dictatorship. Chile is a very original country. It chose in a popular democratic election the first Marxist socialist president in the world.
Your uncle?
My uncle. And it got rid of a dictatorship without violence, also with a democratic election.
What was it like for you when your uncle Salvador Allende was elected president in 1970? How did that affect your status in your own culture?
It didn't affect it at all. I was not involved in politics at the time. And Salvador Allende was a member of an extended family for me. I wasn't so close to him as I was to... Well, actually, he was a very good friend of my stepfather. So in that sense, we were closer.
No, he was the brother of...
He was the cousin of my father.
The cousin of your father?
Yeah, he was the cousin of my father. But when my father disappeared when I was very young, he remained very close to my mother. So I was brought up seeing him often, him and his family, sharing picnics and vacations and that kind of thing, but never involved in politics, really. When he was elected, I wasn't even aware of what had happened, really. I would just went on with my job. I really became aware of the historical figure that he had become after the coup and after I left Chile, because everybody was talking about it, and he seemed to have this historical dimension that I was not aware of.
When you say that your father disappeared when you were young, do you mean that he just left the family?
Yes.
And didn't keep in touch, or was there something more mysterious than that?
There was something mysterious that I don't know what it is, and my mother won't say. I imagine that he did something terrible, but I don't know what it was. And he was never in touch with us again. I never saw him. All his photographs were destroyed. And many years later, when I was 26 years old, I was called to the morgue to identify a body, and that's the only time I ever saw him.
Oh, and it was his body?
It was his body. He died in the street of a heart attack. And they called me because they found his papers, and they wanted someone from Allende's family to identify the body, but I couldn't because I had never seen him. I had never even seen a picture of him. So I called my stepfather, and he knew him, and he identified him. So we buried him.
Well, gee.
Soap opera.
Really?
A soap opera.
Really? So you went to look at the body, even though you knew you wouldn't recognize him, but this was your chance to see him.
No, I went to look for the body because he had my brother's name, and I thought it was my brother, because at that time, my brother was in a cult, and we hadn't seen him for a year.
Your brother was in a cult?
For a time, yes. Fortunately, he got out of it.
What kind of cult was it?
Some guy from Argentina that called Silo, and he made up that name. And he invented some sort of religion in which he was the new Messiah, a little bit like David Koresh, but less threatening, probably.
So did your brother leave the cult?
He left it, but he was 6 years there. Wow. A long time.
Uh-huh.
So at the time, when I was looking for him, I stumbled upon the dead body of my father.
What was your mother's reaction to your father's death?
She hadn't seen him for a very long time, and I don't know what happened between them, but she was very sad. She felt very sad.
So you said that you weren't really very political until after the coup, after the assassination of your uncle in 1973. As soon as the coup happened, how did you find out about the coup? Where were you and how did you hear about it?
Well, like everybody else did, I was at home and I was getting ready to go to my office. I took the car. I didn't have a radio in the car. And I was driving to my office and I saw that the streets were empty. The only vehicles that you saw were military trucks and tanks. And people had been talking about a coup for a long time, but we had no experience in such a thing because Chile had been the longest democracy in Latin America. So we thought that military coups only happen in banana republics. And so I wasn't even scared. I thought, what is this? And I just went on driving. And I reached my office and I found the building closed and a soldier at the door. And they told me that there was a military coup and I should go back home. But I stopped in a friend's house and she told me that her husband had left very early in the morning and had gone to a school where he was a teacher downtown. And there was no transportation for him to come back. So I went downtown to pick him up, and that's how I saw the bombardment of the palace, and I was very close when it happened.
Were you endangered by virtue of being a member of the Allende family?
I don't think so. I think that I could have stayed in Chile if I had not gotten involved in activities that were forbidden by the regime. At the beginning, right after the coup, the Mexican embassy offered a plane to take the family out of the country. And actually, those who were not in prison or dead left. And they lived in exile in Mexico or in Cuba or in other countries for many years. But at the time, I didn't think that it was necessary to leave. I thought that we had no tradition in military coups. The soldiers would go back to their barracks very soon, and we would have elections again. So I stayed, and as soon as the curfew was lifted after 48 hours, I realized that some of my friends were hiding and that people needed help. And I did what many other people did because we didn't know the rules, and there are no rules in terror. I just helped as much as I could, and then I got more and more involved, and there was a point where the circle of repression was just closing around my neck.
What was the type of thing that you did to help?
Hide people, find asylum, smuggle information out of the country.
Where would you hide people?
In my house or in other people's houses. We have to move them every night.
Did you have a taste for the kind of risk and danger that this entailed?
I didn't have an idea of what I was doing. When I learned the risk that it involved, I was terrified because it was not only me, it was also my family that was in danger. You know, at that time, they were torturing children in front of their parents to force them to confess. And actually, when you do this kind of thing, there's nothing that you can confess because you don't know the names of the people you're hiding. You keep them only for one night. So it's part of a network of people who are doing this kind of activity, and it's organized in such a way that you're not supposed to know much.
So did you decide to leave when you did, in part because you were afraid of the rest of your family?
I was afraid for myself, the rest of the family. I was threatened, and I had some contacts, people who knew me and were kind enough to tell me that I was in danger. So maybe I was not, but who can tell? I mean, it's so difficult to know what you have to do or if there is a real risk or not. And anyhow, I thought there was a moment when I was just terrified and I thought that I couldn't stand anymore.
How did you get out?
With a passport on a plane. Early in the morning, I just left, terrified because I thought I might be stopped in the airport.
Well, sure, if your name was on a list, that would be a logical thing to
think.
Yeah,
but it wasn't so well organized.
Mm-hmm. So did you stay involved with the Chilean resistance after you left Chile?
To a certain extent, but I was at a level of survival when I left. I didn't have a visa, I didn't have money, I didn't have a job, I didn't have friends. So at the time, I was also angry at myself because I had put myself in that situation. And when I went to Venezuela, I really needed, first of all, to find a job and a place to stay and wait for my kids. I mean, I missed my kids and my husband.
Do you think that your whole personality changed by virtue of what you saw in Chile?
Yes, not only mine, but I think practically everybody in Chile changed. First of all, you could not remain neutral. You have to have a position for or against the dictatorship. And whatever that position was determined your future life. And my position was very clear. I was against it. And for a while, I was willing to take all the risks. Then later, I wasn't. I was much more of a coward than I ever thought I was.
Well, do you consider it a sign of cowardice or a sign of just realism that you left when you did?
Many people who were just as realistic as I was stayed and took the risk.
So on the one hand, you're angry with yourself for having stayed because you didn't realize that the coup would really last. On the other hand, you're angry with yourself for having left.
You know, that's what the dictatorship achieved, to make the victims feel guilty.
No matter what you do.
No matter what you do.
Writer Isabel Allende is my guest. We're going to take a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Isabel Allende. Her new novel is called The Infinite Plan. So you had been, I think, a journalist when you were
Yes.
in Chile. And then I think you were about 39 or something when you actually started writing fiction. What happened in the intervening years?
Paralysis, total emotional paralysis. I couldn't do anything. I did all sorts of odd jobs to support my family. I couldn't write because I didn't I didn't know that I could write fiction at the time. I was trying to work as a journalist and couldn't get a job as a journalist. I never adapted in Venezuela, although Venezuela is a very generous and open country. I was always looking south, wanting to go back and with my suitcases packed.
So after all these odd jobs, you started writing fiction?
Yeah, I think that for many years I had all these unwritten events, like stored somewhere, suffocating me. And then one day, it was January 8th, 1981, we received a phone call from Chile saying that my grandfather was dying. And I decided to write him a sort of spiritual letter. And I started writing, and I went on writing and writing, and I could never stop. I wrote every night for a year, and then I had 500 pages on my table. And my mother said, this doesn't look like a letter anymore. It's probably a book. And that was The House of the Spirits. So it's amazing to see how now they're making this super production, this great movie, with something that started in such a humble way.
You're among Latin America's best-known women writers.
I hope that someday someone will drop the women word, and I will be just a good writer, for heaven's sake.
Oh, no, but what I was leading to was, do you think it's been any harder for you or for other women to get published in Latin America? Do you think that that there are obstacles you face that a male counterpart would not?
Yes, I definitely think so. In a male chauvinist patriarchal society, women are supposed to be silent. They should not be creative because it's dangerous for the structure of the society if they speak up. And writing is the most visible way of speaking up. And women have been condemned to silence for 500 years in my continent, and they still are. More and more women are writing, more of them are being published, and now even some movies are being made with some women writers, like The Official History, like Water for Chocolate, and many others.
Do you feel that you were condemned to silence as a young woman or
yes.
as a girl?
Yes. I didn't receive an education. I was not supposed to be anything else but a housewife and a mother and a good wife, if possible. I had to work all my life, and I like it, and I really enjoyed being a journalist, but I never went to the university. I did not finish high school. And my brothers, on the other hand, were stimulated and even forced to have an education because they were men.
When did you actually become aware of that double standard?
When I was 5 years old, and I remember exactly the moment.
What was it?
I was sitting in the living room in my grandfather's house with my mother, and she was trying to teach me to knit. And through the window, I could see my brothers climbing a tree. And then I was there trying to pass the yarn through these needles. And my mother said, sit with your legs crossed like a lady. And I realized that I not only had to be doing this thing, which I hated, but I also had to be sitting in an uncomfortable position while my brothers were climbing the tree. And I wanted to be a man. I wanted to be like my grandfather, like my brothers, not like my mom.
Did you do anything to rebel against the feminine role that they had scripted for you?
Yes, always, but I got a lot of aggression, and I could not articulate that anger. I didn't know that it had a name, it had a language, it had a way of expressing it and changing those rules. I was just very angry, very rebellious, and I got a lot of aggression. And then when I was old enough to work in a women's magazine, my friends who were writing in this radical feminist magazine were reading North American feminists in translation. And I started reading those books, and I realized that they were years ahead and that they had a language and they could articulate these thoughts even with humor, with irony. And I thought, God, it was like a revelation.
Who were you reading?
Well, Gloria Steinem, Germaine Greer. I remember The Female Eunuch changed my life. It gave me a language to express what I was feeling.
So once you had the language, how did you use it?
I was a feminist journalist all my career. I had a feminist humorous column in a magazine, and then a TV show every week. I would make fun of men, and men loved it, actually. But it was a very feminist way of expressing it.
So what did that do to your reputation, being a feminist?
I had the reputation of being a raging feminist, but because I used humor, I was forgiven, in a way.
Were you married already?
Yes, I was married, and my husband and nobody else took me really seriously.
It's funny, a lot of relationships that started before a woman kind of realized the inequities of gender ended up falling apart because the marriage was based on an unequal relationship, and once the woman demanded equality, discovered that her husband wasn't the right person, or her boyfriend wasn't the right person.
It wasn't that way with me, actually, because as I said before, I had always been very angry and very rebellious, mm-hmm. even if I couldn't articulate it. So when I met my husband, he knew how I felt, and I think he was the right person for a while. And what really destroyed our marriage was not the fact that I was a feminist, because I had always been one, but exile. I think that happened to many, many families, that once they were away from the support of the group and the social rules that keep you together, and you are naked in front of each other, alone in a foreign place, trying to survive, then you realize who the other person is, essentially. And sometimes you fall out of love.
Yeah. You're living in California, where there's a lot of Spanish culture. Do you feel any kind of connection to the California aspects of Spanish culture?
Yes, and that's what my new book is about. It's about this love-hate relationship between Anglos and Latins that has been going on for so long. And it's about my privileged position as a person who has a foot in each culture and can speak both languages and can understand the fears of both.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
And my guest has been Isabel Allende. Her new novel is called The Infinite Plan. This is Fresh Air.